Hello and welcome to Your Good Health Radio. I'm your host, Dr. David Friedman, and today we're diving deep into one of my favorite topics, gut health, the true foundation for our overall wellness. And joining us is the incredible Dr. William Davis, author of the groundbreaking Wheat Belly series. And for decades, he's been unraveling the fascinating connections between foods we eat and their profound impact on our immune system, metabolism, memory, and longevity. Whether you're battling digestive challenges, feeling tired and sluggish, or are you simply just looking to optimize your health? Dr. Davis is here to transform your perspective on food, your microbiome, and life. Don't go anywhere. The good health starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
My next guest is a renowned cardiologist, passionate health advocate, and number one New York Times bestselling author behind the influential Wheat Belly series. Through his groundbreaking books, including Wheat Belly, Wheat Belly Total Health, and Super Gut, he's empowered millions to rethink the relationship with food, gut health, and overall wellness. As a respected pioneer in microbiome-based therapies, he's the co-founder and chief medical officer of Realize Therapeutics. He's also the creator behind the popular Dr. Davis Infinite Health website and host of the Defiant Health Radio podcast. It reaches audiences worldwide with actionable health insights. And I'm excited to say he has a new book coming out, which I've had the privilege of previewing, and it's a phenomenal read. So we'll talk just a tad about that. And welcome back to the show, Dr. William Davis.
Oh, thrilled to be back, Dr. Friedman.
Yeah, so great to have you back. Now, since your last visit, there's been an explosion of fascinating research on gut health. And what's one of the most surprising new discoveries about our gut bacteria that most people might not be aware of?
You know, people have been fermenting foods for eons, right? They ferment sauerkraut and ferment meats and kimchi and kefirs. And those are microbes that are typically resident, are found on the surface of vegetables. But I think there's a new way to look at fermentation, that is to ferment human microbes, microbes that are sourced from humans, whether it comes from breast milk or the gastrointestinal tract, the vagina, the skin, the mouth. Now, we got to be selective, of course. We want to pick microbes that are beneficial and not the ones that do harm to us.
Yeah, that's the wave of the future. I hadn't heard much about that. I do know that what shocks me, Doc, is, you know, grandparents, our generation back then, they didn't have the gut problems we have today. And what do you believe is the primary factors behind this dramatic rise in IBS, Crohn's, and ulcerative colitis? Is it more toxins, declining food quality, or perhaps just the widespread use of pharmaceuticals? Why are we so sick today and we can't really blame DNA?
Yes, 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 and yes. So, you know, the best evidence, of course, is for the antibiotics. Currently, for every 1,000 adults, about 2/3 of us receive an antibiotic every year. That's also true for children. Most people by age 40 have taken 30 courses of antibiotics. So we're inundated. Now, sometimes those antibiotics are necessary. If you had pneumococcal pneumonia, for instance, or a urinary tract infection, we could argue that the antibiotics are necessary in that situation. But as you know, they're often dispensed kind of loosely, and people are given antibiotics for what might be a viral infection that could convert to bacterial. And so we're wildly overexposed to antibiotics, but I believe it goes beyond that, though the evidence is still evolving. But I think we could argue that the glyphosate herbicide, that is the active ingredient in Roundup, is an herbicide, yes, but it's also an antibiotic. But it's an antibiotic of the worst sort because it selects. It kills beneficial microbes and doesn't kill undesirable microbes, like fecal microbes. And then there's other herbicides, of course, and pesticide residues in our food, preservatives in food that prevent mold, for instance, from growing on your food, but also is antimicrobial in your GI tract, emulsifying agents that like polysorbate 80 or carboxymethyl cellulose or carrageenan, a long list of those things, that keep foods mixed for aesthetic purposes. But also, like an ice cream, for instance, it keeps it from when you thaw and refreeze it, it separates into solids and ice. Well, to prevent that, they add a ton of emulsifying agents. Well, that emulsifies your mucus barrier. You know, even the bowel prep, ethylene glycol, the stuff used to prepare you for a colonoscopy, that is a massive disruptor of a mucus barrier, an effect that lasts for several days. Synthetic sweeteners like aspartame, and sucralose have been shown to change the microbiome. Chlorinated drinking water. In other words, we almost can't escape all the things that disrupt the composition of the gastrointestinal microbiome. And also, by the way, skin microbiome, oral microbiome, vaginal microbiome, bladder. So as you know, as the science improves, we're starting to recognize that every organ has its unique microbial signature, and we've disrupted many of those microbiomes body-wide.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You know what gets me is autoimmune diseases are on the rise where the body attacks itself, and it's been linked to an imbalanced microbiome. Could you shed some light on this connection and maybe what steps we can take to untangle this complex relationship?
You know, I think it's been my view for some time, though I didn't believe this until a few years ago, that the real driver of a lot of disease, whether it's an autoimmune disease or a neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's disease, or even just weight gain, obesity, abdominal obesity especially, hypertension, coronary disease, atrial fibrillation, skin rashes like rosacea, psoriasis, or eczema and acne, emotional conditions, stress, anxiety, these are all driven by what's called endotoxemia, that is, the flood of microbial breakdown products into the bloodstream. You can't measure it clinically because that test is not available clinically, but you can measure it in research. The most common compound that disrupts all these things is lipopolysaccharide endotoxin. So the process is called endotoxemia. I think it's becoming clearer as the science unfolds that the real driver of a lot of this is when we've gotten exposed to all those things, antibiotics, glyphosate, et cetera, and we've killed off literally hundreds of beneficial species that previously suppressed or kept at bay fecal microbes in the colon. These are species like E. coli, Salmonella, Campylobacter, which, by the way, are also many of the same microbes of food poisoning. But these are fecal microbes. The fecal microbes, no longer suppressed by beneficial bacteria, overproliferate and then remarkably ascend into the 24 feet of small intestine. So the situation is 24 feet of small intestine, wildly overpopulated by fecal microbial species that live and die in the space of a few hours. They don't live very long, but when they die, they shed their toxic compounds into the intestines. And because the small intestine is by design very permeable, because that's where we absorb, of course, amino acids, fatty acids, vitamins, minerals, these bacterial toxins enter the bloodstream, endotoxemia. And that's how bowel flora in the small intestine can export its effects to the skin, the brain, joints, other parts of the body. And I think that's the key concept here, that endotoxemia, so this the process is called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, of course, SIBO, S-I-B-O, that results in endotoxemia. And so you and I see, of course, conventional healthcare doing things like giving you a biologic to block some pathway in inflammation if you have rheumatoid arthritis or psoriatic arthritis or some other condition, or give you a medicine to force down blood pressure, or give you a medication to try to boost serotonin in your brain to alleviate depression, but never paying attention to the contribution, the major contribution of microbes in the small bowel and the resulting endotoxemia. You know, there's a really telling study, a series of studies actually came from Germany. I'm always shocked that they did this. It's been recognized for years that people who are depressed, there are people who respond to the antidepressants, the SSRIs. There are people who don't respond. There's a lot of those, by the way. And it's a terrible situation. If you're depressed, maybe near suicidal, you're given a drug for a few weeks, you go back to the psychiatrist or the primary care, and you say, that's not working. Let's increase the dose. A few weeks later, it's not working. Let's change the drug. A few weeks later, it's not working. Let's increase the dose. This can go on for 6 months to a year. And the entire time, you are intractably depressed. So this question was asked, what's the difference? What distinguishes people who respond to the drugs to the people who don't respond? Which become clear, the people who don't respond to the antidepressant drugs have inflammation. So the question was asked by this German research group, well, where's this inflammation coming from? So they did something extraordinary. They took that lipopolysaccharide endotoxin and injected it into normal, non-depressed people, which is what makes that shocking, is if you miscalculate even a little bit, you can kill somebody very easily. So they injected this lipopolysaccharide endotoxin into these normal, non-depressed participants. And within 3 hours, they were clinically depressed. And they performed MRI scans to look at the brains, and the brain patterns were identical to people who had severe depression. So a pretty good illustration of the cause-effect relationship of bacterial breakdown products in the bloodstream as a driver of depression, as well as numerous other conditions.
Yeah, that brings me to a good point. You talk about bowel flora. What's your perspective on the fecal microbiota transplantation for like autoimmune gut conditions? And something I want to get your take on. I read, correct me if it's wrong, if a skinny person gets the microbiota transplant from an obese person, they will gain weight. That's mind-blowing. Truth to that?
There is truth to that. The list of conditions that respond to fecal transplantation is growing. There are some hazards, and of course, there's been kind of a moratorium on fecal transplant because some people died because they were not fully screening people. They do screen people, that is so-called donors of their stool, for such things as HIV, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, and other infectious diseases. They did not screen them for such things as this, as the SIBO, for instance, because in SIBO, there's typically overproliferation of all those fecal microbes. It could be E. coli, could be Campylobacter, it could be Staphylococcus, it could be Streptococcus, it could be any number of overgrown, unhealthy species. And when you give that to a person, somebody else, they can get very sick. And so there's been a moratorium, an effort to better screen people. And the list, by the way, the people who are truly healthy donors is a very small list, because as you know, disruption of the gastrointestinal microbiome is pretty much a ubiquitous phenomenon now in modern society. So it does have a role. I think, though, in parallel to direct transplantation of someone's poop into your rectum, there's also this effort where they took poop from donors, healthy donors, and concentrated the microbes into a capsule form and then consumed orally. And that has equivalent efficacy to stool transplantation into the rectum, about 92% efficacy, telling us that it doesn't have to be direct instillation into the rectum or higher up with a colonoscope, but it's the reimplantation of microbial species. Of course, the difficulty is here, which species are they talking about?
Right, right.
Which species are necessary, which are not?
Yeah, that makes sense. You made me think that if somebody got the transplantation of the fecal and they had a bad reaction, you could literally say, I hate your guts. You made me sick. You made me, you're supposed to make me better. I hate your guts.
Very nice.
Yeah, as I hinted earlier, you've got an exciting new book coming out. I did mention the title since I heard it might be changing. Can you share just a quick preview on what the listeners can look forward to?
Yeah, it won't come out till December or January, later this year, and maybe into 2026, but it's called Superbody. Based on a little clinical trial I performed, you know, one of the things I do is restore this microbe lost by the majority of Americans called Lactobacillus reuteri. I tell ladies about all the wonderful effects that can occur on joint health, gastrointestinal health, mental health, etc. Well, the ladies always say to me, we don't care about all that. We just want better skin. So I said, okay, all right. So to validate that, I did a small clinical trial on ladies over 90 days. It was reuteri and some other things. And we did indeed record an increase in dermal thickness, dermal collagen. Ladies were thrilled because their wrinkle depth was reduced, had smoother skin. But what took me by surprise was that their waist circumferences were reduced on average about 3 inches, as much as 8.5 inches. Even though we did not ask them to change their diet or their exercise program or anything, just get these four things in capsule form. And so it became clear that we're influencing body composition, what I call shape and body composition. This led to a whole list of insights into how better manage weight loss. You know, one of the problems with weight loss, whether it's a GLP-1 agonist like Wegovy or Ozempic, or whether it's bariatric procedure like Lap-Band or gastric bypass, or even just a reduced calorie diet, as many commercial programs are, or mantras like move more, eat less. These are all variations on the same theme, reducing calorie intake. Well, we now know with good evidence, a lot of it comes from our own National Institutes of Health, the NIH, that when you reduce calories, regardless of the method, you will lose muscle. About 25% of the weight you lose is muscle. So if, let's say, somebody pays $12,000 to lose 40 pounds by injecting themselves with one of those drugs, well, of that 40 pounds lost, 10 pounds is muscle. When you stop the drug, because most people can't afford those drugs forever, you regain about 32 pounds. You regain more fat than you had in the beginning, and you don't regain the 10 pounds of muscle. You might gain a couple pounds back. In other words, and what happens long-term is the loss of muscle, we know with confidence, reduces your basal metabolic rate. That is the rate at which your body burns calories for the work of living, breathing, digestion, etc. So there's about a 25-27% reduction in basal metabolic rate, and it's essentially permanent. It doesn't come back, at least not for many years. And that guarantees that you will regain the weight as fat, even if you maintain a low-calorie lifestyle and intensive exercise program. You know, this played out in that TV show, The Biggest Loser. Remember that? The NIH actually studied the graduates of the eighth season and recorded that these people lost extraordinary quantities of weight. They looked terrific. They left the show. And to their credit, virtually every single one of them maintained a low-calorie lifestyle and a very intensive exercise program. And they, all but one, regained all the weight. The winner, I talked to the winner, Danny Cahill, great guy. He lost 239 pounds in 200 days, which just sounds impossible. He won. He got the $250,000 prize. But he was one of the people studied who experienced a dramatic reduction in basal metabolic rate. Well, I talked to him. That's been some years since he graduated from the show. The poor guy is beaten and demoralized because he regained all the weight, even though he maintained a very strict, this is a very driven guy, maintained a very strict low-calorie lifestyle and 2 hours a day, 6 days a week of intensive exercise, resistance, and aerobic training. And so it illustrates the dangers of losing muscle. And now, even worse, we have large databases of people who've lost weight. We have the NHANES, the Epic Norfolk from Europe, about 50,000 people who've been tracked. What happens to people who lose weight by reducing calories? They die several years younger. Well, their benefits seem to be up front, better metabolic measures, et cetera, looking better. You die younger. And those last few years are much more likely to be marked by falls, fractures, frailty, loss of independence, and then premature death. And so if we have some way to maintain or even increase muscle, that would be a huge advantage.
So true. So you mentioned your favorite microbe is the Lactobacillus reuteri. What about weight loss supplements and fat burners? The options are endless. Is there any that gets your seal of approval, or are they all just garbage?
There's several problems. As you know, there's two so-called compartments of fat. There's subcutaneous fat. That's fat below the skin surface. You could have it in your neck, in your chest, in your buttocks, in your thighs. That's kind of metabolically not very dangerous. It may be an aesthetic issue, but it's not metabolically dangerous. It's the fat in the abdomen that is that encircles the intestines, liver, kidneys, etc. So-called abdominal visceral fat. That's the source of inflammation, insulin resistance, all those things. So if you want to lose fat, you want to target abdominal visceral fat. And then the subcutaneous fat will follow as you correct yourself metabolically. Well, all the drugs are specific for subcutaneous fat. So the metabolic benefits are not as great as they could be. And then there's that loss of muscle. And that loss of muscle is really a big problem. It's very difficult to regain lost muscle. If you lost, so someone like Danny Cahill, who lost over 200 pounds of weight, probably lost on the order of 40, 50 pounds of muscle, even though he was engaging in resistance training. I talk to the docs who dispense these GLP-1 agonists, and I tell them, hey, you know, you got to be concerned about muscle loss. And I say, don't worry. I have all my patients go to the gym for resistance training. Well, I tell them, well, the evidence is quite clear. You can't block the loss of muscle. You can only blunt it. So in one of those NIH studies, while the expected muscle loss is 25%, they lost only 18%. So it did reduce the loss of muscle, but it didn't prevent it. And those people thereby have a marked reduction in basal metabolic rate and thereby guaranteed to regain the weight and be less metabolically healthy and probably die several years younger.
Yeah, what concerns me is just the GLP-1s is the muscle loss. As you're older, that means you lose your balance. You fall. I had a patient, broke her hip. She's 78. She's on the Ozempic. And it's like, well, you know, maybe she had a weak muscle. She couldn't. So I'm saying that we need our leg strength as we get older because a big killer is hip fractures, correct? Wouldn't we see those increase as this continued Ozempic craze goes on and on?
You know, they approve these drugs, Dr. Friedman, without those kinds of long-term outcome studies. But given what we do know, it is virtually guaranteed that we're going to see more falls and fractures, frailty, because of these drugs and other efforts to lose weight. So it's really, in my view, it's a tragedy that these drugs were approved.
Yeah, I agree. Let me ask you this. Your groundbreaking book, this question comes up with me, and I want to bring it to you. It was Wheat Belly helped ignite the grain-free movement. How is it that some people experience severe reactions to gluten while others can eat the pasta, the pizza, the bagels every day, have zero issues, et cetera? Are you sure you can eat that whole pizza and you're fine? Yeah, I love it. I go, I'm thinking, if I have two pieces, I feel like crap. Could it be that they're experiencing these issues but aren't aware of them? Is that what am I missing here, that people can eat gluten and they're fine, or we just think they're fine?
You're absolutely right. They're experiencing effects they're not aware of. So for instance, so this over concentration or focus on gluten or gliadin ignores the amylopectin A, for instance. So amylopectin A is the carbohydrate unique to wheat and grains that triggers, for instance, formation of small LDL particles, the real cause for heart disease. LDL cholesterol is not the cause for heart disease. It's a crude indirect biomarker that was introduced in the 1950s and 60s to guesstimate the number of particles in the bloodstream that cause heart disease. But in that time, 50s and 60s, they didn't know how to measure these kinds of things. We can now. I've been doing it for 30 years. You can characterize these things, and you'll see that people who consume the amylopectin A of wheat and grains have an explosion in this marked risk factor for heart disease, heart attack, sudden cardiac death, need for bypass, stents, all that kind of stuff. And we now have 55 clinical trials to tell us that small LDL is markedly superior to LDL cholesterol as a biomarker for heart disease. When you consume something made of wheat, and thereby the amylopectin A of the carbohydrate, you provoke formation of small LDL particles for 5 to 7 days. As opposed to a large LDL, a normal large LDL particle provoked by consumption of fat, which persists for about 24 hours, a single day. The reason for that is when you provoke formation of a small LDL, the protein on the surface of that particle, apoprotein B it's called, is concealed and the liver doesn't recognize it. So the small LDL goes around your circulation, around and around and around, giving it lots of opportunity to enter the walls of arteries and trigger the formation of atherosclerosis. That small LDL is also much more prone to oxidation and glycation, that is glucose modification, making it much more likely to cause atherosclerotic plaque. And that small particle, because it's smaller, is better able to enter the walls of arteries and instigate an inflammatory reaction. So for a variety of reasons, small LDL is a nasty player in causing heart disease. And heart disease is serious stuff. People are dying every day because they're being given silly things like statin cholesterol drugs or being told to cut their saturated fat or total fat. Inadequate device. You know, we did a clinical trial many years ago and we were tracking coronary disease, coronary atherosclerosis, by doing coronary calcium scoring, which remains a good technique even today. That is using calcium as a dipstick, an indirect gauge of how much coronary atherosclerotic plaque you have. Normal would be zero. But let's say somebody had a pretty high score, like 400, meaning they have a moderate to severe amount of coronary atherosclerosis in their three coronary arteries. Well, how fast will that score increase if you did nothing? Well, doing nothing is not smart, but what if you did? And we did this in the trial. It goes up 25% per year. So 400 becomes 500 a year later, 625, and you're closer with each leap to dying, having a heart attack, needing a procedure. Well, what if we put you on a baby aspirin, a high dose of Lipitor or other statin cholesterol drug, cut the saturated fat and total fat in your diet, put you on an exercise program, what my colleagues to this day call optimal medical therapy? How fast will that score go up? 25% per year. It has zero impact on progression of coronary disease. Yet to this day, that's what they're still doing. So this is why I had to devise a way to put a stop to it. And one of the things you pay attention to is small LDL particles. And the only foods that cause small LDL particles, wheat, grains, and sugar. Wheat and grains cause amylopectin A. So there are lots of other reasons not to eat wheat, but that's one big reason. Wheat causes heart disease. It's a week-long increase in risk.
Got that. So they may be feeling fine today. That pizza didn't bother me, but long term, that's what they need to focus on. Interesting. Let me ask you this. With testing for gut issues, it's overwhelming with, you got stool analysis, blood tests, biomarkers, food sensitivity panels. I'm curious, which test, if any, do you find insightful for assessing gut health? Is the one that's your go-to?
You know, I think, first of all, people just look at what kind of symptoms they had. So with regards to this SIBO issue, which, by the way, is half the U.S. population, we're not talking about a rare thing. I make that claim because all we need to do is go to the several dozen clinical studies that ask this question. In condition blank, what proportion of people test positive for SIBO? Usually using detection of hydrogen gas in the breath, because microbes produce hydrogen gas, we do not. And so you can use various methods to map where microbes are living. Are they in the colon where they're supposed to be? Or are they in the stomach, duodenum, and jejunum where they don't belong? So using that method, let's insert into the blank obesity. Of the 110 or so million Americans with obesity, what proportion tests positive? About 50%. Well, that's about 55 million people right there. How about in people with irritable bowel syndrome? So there's 60 to 70 million people with IBS. About 31% will test positive. That's another 20 million or so. Add up all those conditions, restless leg syndrome, fibromyalgia, autoimmune conditions, type 2 diabetes, neurodegenerative, add them all up. You easily exceed 150 million people or half the country. I didn't believe it at first. I thought, there's no way, until we got a consumer device. So you can get tested in the lab or clinic, of course, for hydrogen gas. But there's now a consumer device, came out in 2018, called the AIR device, A-I-R-E. I have no relationship with the company. And you can test in the comfort of your own home hydrogen gas. And there's a specific protocol to do it. It's very easy. And you can detect, you can map where microbes are occurring. To my great surprise, it's everywhere. Now, we might argue, well, maybe the method, maybe the device is flawed. But what I saw is this. People who tested positive, then took steps to eradicate their SIBO, had dramatic health improvements. So many people go wheat and grain free. We add some nutrients lacking in modern life, like vitamin D and magnesium, and then address the microbiome. But they still had some residual health problems. It could have been weight. They could have said something like, well, I did the wheat and grain free and did the other things, and I lost 73 pounds, but I still have 45 more to go, and I hit a plateau. I can't seem to break it. Or I was a type 2 diabetic, and my hemoglobin A1C was 11.7, which is terrible, of course. And I did your program, and it dropped to 6.5. I'm still borderline diabetic, and I can't seem to get it lower. When we addressed the microbiome, but specifically SIBO and endotoxemia, we saw everything give way. The weight plateau broke, hemoglobin A1C dropped to below 5%. In other words, all the residual problems went away when we addressed the microbiome.
Very interesting. Yeah, time's flying by. I had so many questions for you. Last one, I've had patients ask, hey, does eating yogurt really help with the probiotics? It's pasteurized. It's got all these ingredients. It's processed. I'm curious, yes or no? Is that a good source of real, true, live probiotics in there?
It can be. But the problem with commercial yogurt is there's a number of problems. One, it's fermented for a very brief period, typically 6 to 12 hours. Let's take one of the microbes we ferment, Lactobacillus reuteri. It doubles every 3 hours at human body temperature. So if you're going to ferment for 6 to 12 hours, you only got a couple of doublings, and you get very low numbers. So when we make yogurt, we double for 36 hours or 12 doublings. And when we count using a method called flow cytometry, the number of microbes, we get on the order of 300 billion. So while commercial yogurt might have a few hundred million or even a few billion, we're going to get hundreds of billions. Another thing is that commercial yogurts typically ferment with what I would guard as kind of ho-hum microbes, like Lactobacillus bulgaricus or Streptococcus thermophilus or Lactobacillus acidophilus. These are modestly beneficial microbes. Let's choose microbes that have huge benefits. So those are the ones I choose. And also, when you buy commercial yogurt, they tend to add things. They tend to add thickening agents like gelatin gum and xanthan gum, which disrupts your mucus barrier, your intestinal mucus barrier. They tend to add sweeteners, high fructose corn syrup, glucose, sucrose, and other junk ingredients. And so they add these things to make it aesthetically tasty and pleasing. We're going to make yogurt. High microbial counts. You and I and your listeners won't add high fructose corn syrup, of course. We may add some blueberries and some chia seeds or something like that. We're going to get much higher bacterial counts. And it didn't strike me just how unusual it is we're doing until I went to a brewing store, or I was talking to these guys who make beer. they fuss with microbes all the time. They use microbes like Saccharomyces cerevisiae to make beer and wine, and some other microbes like Lactobacillus brevis to affect the taste and texture of beers. So they asked me, what kind of things are you fermenting? I said, human microbes. And they stepped back in horror.
You cannibal.
So it is an unusual thing we're doing.
No, I love it. Last question I got, it's one I've wondered. If you eat yogurt, it's cold, it's refrigerated, might have some healthy probiotics, but you wash it down with a hot cup of coffee or tea, does that destroy the probiotics? It's hitting the stomach at the same time.
It can. So some microbes like Rotari, Gasseri, are susceptible to dying when you get above around 110 or so degrees Fahrenheit. So if you're drinking something that's 120, 130, 140, it can. Now, of course, what you have in your stomach is a matrix. It's not bacteria sitting on top. You probably do kill off some of the microbes. Now, here's an uncertainty. The animal evidence tells us that some microbes are effective both alive and dead. So that's true for Reuteri. That's true for Acromantia. Now, the downside, of course, is when you kill microbes, they're no longer there and viable to take up residence and help you along in future. But the dead microbes still have beneficial effects, probably by some form of metabolite.
Great. 30 seconds left. Anything you'd like to share that we didn't cover today that you want to share with the audience in closing?
Well, one of the things I do is make what I call SIBO yogurt. It's a combination of Lactobacillus reuteri, Lactobacillus gasseri, and a spore former, Bacillus subtilis. And that has been very helpful in managing SIBO. That recipe is in my Super Gut book. It's in my blog, William Davis MD. It's in my membership website, innercircle.drdavisinfinitehealth.com. So I try to make it as available as possible. And we've had an unexpected success with this.
Fantastic. So great having you back with us, sharing your great insights. I hope you'll join us again when your new book hits the shelves, end of the year, beginning of next year. I've read it. It's a grand slam, buddy. I loved reading it, and I wish you great success. To learn more, you can go to williamdavismd.com. And while there, be sure and check out all the many resources available, including articles and videos and his new microbiome course, which we didn't get to touch upon. And you can follow him on Facebook at Dr. William Davis Health. On Instagram, you can find him at Dr. Davis Infinite Health, and on X, William Davis MD. And you can follow me on Facebook and X at Dr. David Friedman. On Instagram, I'm at Dr. D. Friedman. And if you heard Dr. Davis share something today that somebody you know needs to hear, send them a link to this podcast available to yourgoodhealthradio.com and radiomd.com, and peruse our podcast library and share these segments of interest with friends, family, coworkers, and on social media. This information is too important. Don't keep it to yourself. Don't be selfish. Sharing is caring. You can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. More to come. Stay tuned and stay well.